is the next case for argument. Mr. Dvorak.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the Court, my name is Richard Dvorak, and I represent the plaintiff, Arthur Brown. Your Honor, this case involves an issue where the plaintiff, Arthur Brown, contends he did not receive a fair trial in the criminal court. But, of course, this is not a criminal case. This is a civil rights Section 1983 case. And normally that the defendant would be raising a Heck issue. But I don't think that applies in this case because they apparently conceded the Heck issue in this case because he never received his habeas corpus petition because he was no longer in custody. So that leaves the defendants with one bow in their string, and that is collateral estoppel.
One bow in their string?
One arrow.
The one arrow in their, whatever that phrase is. I apologize for mangling that.
There are several, none of which is one bow in that string.
Yeah, to the top, off the top of my head, thank you, Your Honor. That leaves them with one option, let's put it that way, and that is collateral estoppel, and they have to rely on state court principles for that. And when we do that, we also have to be mindful that it is the defendant's burden to prove that no unfairness would apply. And also, because this is a Section 1983 case, we also have to be mindful that the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that if there was a hearing or a trial in the first place that denied the person against whom estoppel is going to be applied of its due process rights, then collateral estoppel should not apply. And that's exactly what we argue in this case, is that Arthur Brown's due process rights were violated in his criminal trial, and therefore it would be error to apply collateral estoppel to his Section 1983 excessive force claim, as did the district court.
So anyone who gets out of prison before they had time to file a habeas case, their trial, their conviction doesn't mean anything when it comes to something like this.
Well, Your Honor, it means something, but it means a Heck doesn't apply, and it means that you review the prior decision under collateral estoppel principles, which have to be, at a minimum, compliant with due process principles, but at...
What aspect of the Illinois law of preclusion doesn't satisfy the federal constitutional requirements? Okay, we're told by 28 U.S.C. 1738 to apply the state law of preclusion because the judgment was rendered by a state court. And I assume if some aspect of state law were unconstitutional, we wouldn't apply it. But what aspect of the state law of preclusion do you say violates the Constitution?
I'm not saying that the state law violates the Constitution.
Well, if no aspect of the state law of preclusion is even said to violate the Constitution, all we do here is apply the Illinois law of preclusion. Now, under Illinois law, what makes the judgment here inapplicable?
And that is because the Illinois law has incorporated the full and fair opportunity issue in its own law. And that, therefore, under Illinois law, beyond the threshold requirements that are met in this case, the person applying collateral estoppel still has to...
You seem, however, to be saying if the judge made a mistake, then there was no full and fair opportunity to litigate. But that's not what full and fair opportunity to litigate means.
No, Your Honor, I don't want to...
guarantee a mistake-free litigation. On that view, there would essentially be no law of preclusion.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that that... it requires a mistake-free trial. It requires a trial that does not violate the due process rights.
You're just equating that with a mistake-free trial. Let me try this from a different perspective. Is there any problem under the due process clause with basing decisions on hearsay?
Not in and of itself.
There's none. That's the holding of Richardson against Perales. Well, your objection to this criminal trial was essentially that some hearsay was used. And if we know that hearsay is compatible with the Due Process Clause, it's not compatible with the Confrontation Clause, but it is compatible with the Due Process Clause, right? But if hearsay is compatible with the Due Process Clause, I don't see what the problem is.
Sure, I'm not contending that there was a hearsay problem in this case. I'm contending there was a Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause problem in this case.
The Due Process Clause does not require confrontation. There is a requirement of confrontation for a criminal judgment, but it's not a requirement of due process. What the requirements for the law of preclusion are essentially the requirements for the entry of a civil judgment, of a proper civil judgment. You seem to say that there can't be any preclusion unless all the requirements for a proper criminal judgment have been entered. And that's where you're losing me.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying is the plaintiff in this case had a right at his trial to confront Officer Fobbs about his claim that he was robbed about the gun. And therefore, that's a violation of the Sixth Amendment right. If it's a violation,
well, a violation of the Sixth Amendment is not a violation of due process. That is, a judgment can be perfectly valid as between A and B, even though there was no confrontation and cross-examination. And what I understand the Supreme Court to be saying in a case like Herring is that there has to be the basic requirements for a valid civil judgment have to be met. You're asking us to go a further step and say there can't be any preclusion unless all the requirements for a valid criminal judgment have been met. And I wonder where that additional requirement comes from.
Your Honor, I would...
It's not from Herring.
I would cite Poynter v. Texas, because in Poynter v. Texas, the Supreme Court has said that a denial of the Confrontation Clause, the denial of cross-examination, is necessarily a due process violation. And if it's necessarily a due process violation, then...
So you then think that Richardson against Perales is wrong, that the use of hearsay in litigation is necessarily a violation of the Constitution.
Your Honor, I'm saying that I'm not arguing that there was any hearsay problems in this case.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, so to move on to the actual factual predicate of why I believe that his due process rights were violated in this case, and that would be fundamentally the denial of cross-examination of Officer Fobbs. And in this case, our theory in the criminal trial was that Arthur Brown did not have a gun, he did not point it at Officer Blackman, and he was shot in the back three times, and a gun was planted on him by Officer Blackman. And he actually had an independent witness who corroborated this. It was stipulated at trial that the gun that my client allegedly pointed at Officer Blackman actually was registered to another Chicago police officer. But the state didn't leave it at that. The state went one step further and called Officer Fobbs to say, this gun was stolen from me back in 1998. And they did that for one purpose only. It was in rebuttal. That was their only point they wanted to make, and that was to cast doubt on the drop gun theory. And we suffered severe prejudice by not being allowed to cross-examine Officer Fobbs about his claim, and the jury was just left to take it as a matter of fact that this gun was robbed from him. And the problem, the prejudice is that if that's the case, that Officer Fobbs' gun was stolen from him in 1998, then it makes our drop gun theory very improbable, because it then would have to go from Fobbs to the street, back to Officer Blackman, and then he plants it, versus a very straightforward theory of our theory is that Fobbs had to get rid of the gun because of the stolen, he had to make up this claim of the stolen weapon, and he gave it to Blackman, who he actually works with. It's a very straightforward theory.
And so he uses it as a throwdown gun, knowing it came from another police officer?
Well, Your Honor, the detectives in this case speak volumes about what happened, because the detectives in this case initially said this gun was cleared, not registered. They put down several times the wrong serial number. We finally caught them, and they had to admit that it was Officer Fobbs' weapon. They knew what was going on with Fobbs' weapon, and that's why they put down the wrong serial number. And I think we were denied a fair trial based on that, and as well as the other issues in this case that I raised about not being able to cross-examine Blackman along about them robbing a store on in police uniform, and also the outrageous claims made by the state's attorney against myself and my client about this conspiracy we concocted to cash in with the city of Chicago. I think All of that in addition to the Brady material that I cited in my brief that was withheld combine to undermine any kind of defense claim that their burden was met, that no unfairness would apply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Layton.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honors, Mr. Brown has conceded that his criminal trial conclusively determined that he threatened Officer Blackman with a gun and that collateral estoppel consequently bars his excessive force claim unless an exception to that doctrine applies. This morning, I will explain that this Court should show deference to the State Court's judgment. Mr. Brown's...
I don't understand what deference has to do with it. We simply have to apply the state law of preclusion, whatever that is.
Correct, Your Honor. As this Court is well aware, the full faith and credit statute is Congress's mandate to the Court to respect the state court's judgments if the state's own courts would do so. And the test for that, if whether there is an exception to that, depends on whether the state court's proceedings fall short of even the minimum standards of due process, or there is some other reason to doubt the fundamental fairness of applying collateral estoppel in a particular case. But Mr. Brown's criminal proceedings satisfied this test. He was able to present evidence to support his defense that he was framed by Officer Blackman with a weapon. He presented an eyewitness, and he was able to cross-examine every witness. Due process does not require that the court commit no errors during the proceedings. If that were the case, then if it were simply a question of whether there was an error or whether there was some piece of evidence that was excluded by the state trial court, then there would be no collateral estoppel in federal court with respect to state court criminal judgments. Virtually every defendant can come forward and claim that there was some piece of evidence he would like to have admitted that was kept out. But that is not the test. That is in contrast to a case such as Jones versus City of Alton, in which the defense was kept out altogether. Mr. Brown was able to present his defense, and his trial, he was given a fair forum in which to raise the challenges he would like to raise in federal court to the state court proceedings. He wants to claim that there were confrontation clause errors or due process errors, but he had the forum to do that in state court, and so long as that proceeding was a fair forum to do that, there is no reason for federal court to wade into the minutiae of what occurred in the state court criminal proceeding. Mr. Brown challenged the errors that he claims occurred all the way through the state court proceedings. The Illinois Appellate Court reviewed and rejected his arguments, and the Illinois Supreme Court declined review. Accordingly, it is not necessary for this court to delve into the minutiae of the evidentiary rulings as Mr. Brown requests. However, even if this court does choose to do that, we submit that none of the errors that Mr. Brown claims occurred rendered the proceeding fundamentally unfair, such that this court should not respect the state court's judgment. We are happy to address any of the specific errors if this court should have questions. Our brief goes into great detail about it. But if there are no questions, we will rest on our brief with respect to the specific errors Mr. Brown is alleging. In short, Mr. Brown had the chance and the opportunity to litigate his defense in state court. The state court proceeding conclusively determined against him that he threatened Officer Blackman with a weapon, and as a result, collateral estoppel prevents him from proceeding with his excessive force claim in federal court. Unless there are further questions, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Dvorak?
Your Honor, counsel has indicated that the due process rights of Arthur Brown were guaranteed because he was able to present evidence, he was able to call witnesses, and he was able to cross-examine witnesses. Well, that can be said of every single criminal defendant in the history of criminal defendants. Maybe not the history, but in recent times.
Alas, no, it can't be said.
In recent time, I should say that. Just because he had a criminal trial does not mean it was one that comported with due process, is the point. And it is by no means my argument that I'm requiring that an error-free trial be the standard. What I'm requesting Your Honors to do is to apply the exact same standard that Your Honors apply in habeas corpus petitions. And that is whether or not...
I don't think you've really grasped the question I asked, maybe because I'm not clear. You seem to say that no judgment can be the basis of preclusion unless the judgment was rendered after all of the standards required for a criminal judgment. The question I'm asking is, why isn't it sufficient for enforceability through the law of preclusion that the procedures required for a valid civil judgment have been followed? This was, in fact, a criminal trial, but why isn't it sufficient for preclusion that all of the requirements for a valid civil judgment have been followed? Because this is a civil case. The preclusion is sought to be used in a civil case.
Your Honor, because we have to look at the type of proceeding that I'm saying violated his due process rights. And the type of proceeding wherein his due process rights were violated was a criminal trial. And therefore, because that was a criminal trial, we should apply the due process standards of a criminal trial in applying collateral estoppel principles.
But that's where you lose me. The Supreme Court would, if you take the procedures that were actually used in this trial, if it were a civil trial, if it were initially a civil lawsuit against Chicago, for example, procedures would unquestionably have been adequate. And then there's later a lawsuit against the officer. The officer invokes defensive non-mutual issue preclusion. There'd be no constitutional problem with that. It would be valid under state law, no constitutional problem. I don't see why the officer's rights are lesser because the first trial was a criminal trial rather than a civil trial.
Because, Your Honor, I believe what the Supreme Court had in mind when they talked about a free and fair opportunity, which was incorporated into Illinois law, and when they required due process principles, is because they were actually looking to the individual hearing and not the type of hearing that you get, whether or not that type of hearing had basic protections. I think they wanted each court to look individually to each and every hearing and determine whether that hearing comported with due process. And I guess that's my distinction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. Our fifth case today.